podcast for David Dames, Law Library Reference, 19th March 2009, room number 243.
Okay. Do I understand my assignment? How many of you recall in first year legal research you were handed out an assignment? Did you get it? Did the professors ask you to read the class and ask if you had any questions? It's there in the paper in front of you, and you say, oh, this is clear. But we know from being on the reference desk that you would start work on it, and we would get these questions on, what does this mean? Actually, in practice, you should be thinking about that before you leave the assigning partner's office, is do I understand my assignment? It sounds pretty basic and simple. So what we suggest is don't just repeat what this English is, rephrase the assignment in your own words so that you're putting it in a context you understand, and if there is something that you are missing, they can say, no, this is what I really mean. I also want to review the just ask rule. I know that this was spoken about in the secondary resources workshop, but it's worth repeating. Is you're going to probably want to ask about jurisdiction, whether or not there are any useful tips, experts in the field, recent publications that could help you with this assignment. The scope of the assignment, if you want to, is it to be just a brief overview or something more in depth? Terms of art, are there any particular terms of art you should think about? Acronyms. Remember, it's like with ERISA, you may have ERISA or Employment Retirement Income Security Act. With all of these, you need to know your acronyms. Sources. Is there a Bible treatise in your particular subject area? They may be able to tell you this. And key cost constraints. How much money can you spend doing this research? This is a big issue. It's always been a big issue, and as you know today, it's an even bigger issue that you have to deal with. So, with that is understanding your assignment.
So, yeah, part of understanding your assignment is asking the question, what am I trying to accomplish? Because that's really bound up in what the assignment is. And what Tricia was talking about with key cost constraints is a big part of that. Because, I'll get to that in a minute, but question of what you're trying to accomplish is you're not just doing like research, you're not just trying to find the answer to something. Part of your assignment is almost always is going to be some sort of document that you're going to have to turn in. And it might be a letter or a contract, might be a memo. The memo could vary a lot from in how long the partner wants it to be. You might be writing pleadings, you might be writing a brief. And you should also understand how this fits into the overall process of your firm dealing with the client's problem.
So, going here, understanding the big picture of dealing with your client's problem, are you doing initial client research? Has litigation already started? Are you discovering whether or not there is an issue? Are you writing a brief? Or you may be in some big ongoing project and you actually have a small part of that big project. So you need to understand where you fit in. And with the big project, you don't have to understand the entire big project and what everybody else is doing, but you need to understand what you are doing and where you relate to other people, because they may also be able to help you. So, and the other thing is if you're in a big project, it's not even a big project, it can happen with anything, is you're going to be given facts that are not relevant to what you were doing. So this is, coming here, is identifying your issue needs, which is identifying the facts you need, the issues, and we strongly recommend writing down the issues and recognizing that you're handed an assignment that sometimes you can have what seems to be a very simple issue, maybe two separate problems that you need to tease apart and then research separately and put back together. That actually happens more frequently than you may suspect, doesn't it, David?
Yeah.
David works on Sundays and deals with a lot of attorneys, and they come in and they like to talk over their assignments with us, and part of the thing he's doing is that they think they've got one problem, and actually what they have is two or three different problems that they need to identify their separate issues. So what you've done is looking at identifying your issue needs, going back to what you are trying to accomplish with these, and looking for the resource that best suits what you are trying to do. This may also be, as like if you're just starting off and you have to teach yourself the law in this area, that you want a more basic source. So you don't want to jump on Lexis and Westlaw and start searching case law. With other sources, when you get into cost constraints, different firms, different institutions are going to have different resources, but there are actually databases such as Hine Online or Index to Legal Periodicals that we subscribe to, and many firms, not all firms, but many firms do subscribe to Hine Online, where they pay a flat annual subscription fee. It is searchable, so you can actually do law review searching without going on Lexis and Westlaw. So this is a cost consideration. So how do you do? We're thinking about my information and my issue, what I'm trying to accomplish, trying to identify the resources I need. So how do we do this, David?
Well, okay. Just some examples, going further with the examples of identifying resources that are available, and like Kirsha was saying, that, you know, that's much more than just a question in the abstract of what you can possibly access. It's really, a lot of that's based on your cost constraints and your time constraints. And so if you're,
David, could you explain how that's also based on time constraints?
Well, yeah, say, for instance, that you work at a small firm, and you need a resource that is at a library like this one, or it's at the courthouse library. You know that you won't be able to go there for a week. You might have to plan that research. And then also, if you're doing research for relatively minor problem, you need the answer tomorrow. You can't go as into depth as you might if you're trying to look at every nuance of some problem. So you might only end up looking at a couple of the major sources and getting a quick answer to that, rather than going and trying to read half of every law review article that was written about this topic. But some of the cost-constrained things that you might find yourself with, are, like, for instance, if you're in a large firm, most large firms have libraries. But you might not have that library down the hall from you, so it could take a little longer to get something out of there if it's across the street in another city. However, if you know that you're going to get in trouble for running up a huge research bill on this assignment, it might be cost effective for you to, you know, get on the phone, have someone ship that book to you or scan those pages in, rather than going on Lexis and Westlaw and running up a large bill. And also that if when you're at a large firm, you might have sort of a specialized internal web page called a portal that's made for your firm or even for your practice group that delivers some key resources to you. You should know what's there so that you don't go, you know, on some site where you're going to be paying a lot more money for that same information. And you might even have books that are given to you every year that have the exactly what you need. So, you know, you wouldn't want to go online and pay for it. You know, one job that I used to have was part of it was sending the 37. I think it was Title 37 on patents to about 200 lawyers across the country, and they just salivated for the new edition to come out because they, you know, they knew that all the information they needed was right there in that book that they had at their desk.
Just the other tip here is if you're with the assigning partner, and this goes back to asking the questions, what Dave was talking, they were usually called desk books. Is there a desk book that covers this topic?
Oh.
If there is, you should have it.
One other major cost constraint that you might run into at a firm, which is not the type of thing that you would really be aware of when you're in law school, is that you might be doing a lot of times research for a client who hasn't hired the firm yet, like it's business development. But to get on to Lexis and Westlaw when you're at a firm, you need a client matter number. They're not a client yet, so you have no client matter number for them. You might be forced to use other resources.
Okay, so how do we identify our resources?
So, to actually figure out what resources are available to you, you know, like I mentioned, this thing on the left here is the list of online resources at our library. Okay, like I said, if you're at a firm, you might have a similar page for your firm or even your practice group. Anywhere that has a library is going to have some page with the online resources that are available. But
I was going to say, notice we have Lexis and Westlaw links. With some of our other online resources, some of them are links to what we consider important websites, but there are also other subscription databases that we buy because they have advantage. You know, here again, Hyde Online is one of them because they can provide material that Lexis and Westlaw does not, and there are other search advantages. And firms, large firms, well, many of them will have the same thing. So Lexis and Westlaw are not the only subscription databases that libraries purchase. Keep that in mind.
And, you know, with the way that they're billed, they can end up being some of the most expensive. And you should know what your contract is if you have access to Lexis or Westlaw, because sometimes your contract will be transactional. Sometimes it will be hourly. And it might only cover certain things, and once you go outside of where your contract covers, the cost can skyrocket. And then in the middle here, this is a list of actually business databases from the undergrad library. And so if you're actually not doing legal research, you're being asked to like research background on a business or something like that, you might have access to some sort of specialized databases like this. And on the right, that is our catalog. Anywhere that has a sizable library, including law firms, are going to have a catalog of books where you can search for the materials in the library by author, subject, title, and keyword.
Help you identify that treatise Bible that you're looking for. And I've got a war story on those business databases from a firm librarian friend who told us that a meeting I was at, the importance of looking at these. He'd gone in on a Monday morning, was greeting a young associate and asked how the weekend was, and the weekend hadn't been so good because, of course, the partner had called the associate into the office at 4:30 on a Friday, needing this information first thing on Monday, and they were looking for debt obligation of a particular company. So this person was going on Lexis, they were going on Westlaw, because as you know, they do have company information available here, looking in the annual reports, various filing data, and it took this individual most of the weekend to obtain the information requested. Of course, the librarian saw this as a teaching moment and said, you didn't look at your practice portal or contact a librarian. Went to the practice portal. I believe the database they used is Mergent, which we also subscribe to for our business school, or the university subscribes to for our business school. Went in. One of the things that you can search for is putting in the company information, pulling up the material, select long-term debt. He did it in 5 minutes. So this is the idea of the importance of knowing what resources you have available and then selecting the correct one.
And I will add about these specialized databases, well, I'm not suggesting anything, that if you're like in solo practice or at a very small firm and you need to access something like that one or two times, a lot of public libraries have subscriptions to these things. You can get to them with your library card sometimes.
Okay, well, say we're starting off, we've given the assignment, we know absolutely nothing about it. So, first thing, if you have not attended the workshop on finding and using secondary resources, it would be a good thing to do, because Tony, who gives the workshop, will go into much greater detail here. But you can start off with your secondary sources, encyclopedias and ALRs. I like to describe a legal encyclopedia as it covers, it's very broad, but the explanation is very shallow. And if it's a New York matter, we of course have New York jurisprudence. Or if it's something, you may find it in the ALR. Now, I like ALRs because they take very narrow topics and treat it in depth. And, of course, giving you references to case law and code sections and other secondary sources you may want to look at, such as your treatise. Now, say you are looking in an encyclopedia or an ALR, and they refer you to a treatise. You can go back and you can see if we have it by looking on the online catalog. So, okay, David, I think you have a...
Yeah, so, you know, say that you have someone who walks into your office, their potential client. It's a guy who is being denied paternity leave. He thinks he might be entitled to it. You don't know. You don't actually do a lot of employment law, but you think you might take him on as a client. Before you do, you just want to see if he has any potential claim whatsoever. So you find probably through your catalog or maybe even from a research guide. You can access tons of great research guides. They're especially good for areas of practice that you're not completely familiar with to find the best resources. And the way to find them is just Google legal research guide and then your topic. And if you go to a .edu site, that's probably from an academic law library, and that'll be a good resource for you. And so you find that you have access to these resources, and the first one you see that looks the easiest is an encyclopedia.
And here again, so that's looking, so you can, if you know nothing about it, you start again with your encyclopedia to get you your background information, so that you can understand the analysis that you're looking at in the terms of art if you did not have that. Then if you, so say you've gone to the encyclopedia, you've gone to a treatise, but you're still maybe looking for maybe more current or cutting-edge analysis, you may want to look for a current law review or PLI article. PLI's Practicing Law Institute. They're very good because they're written by lawyers for lawyers on cutting-edge arguments. And say we're talking about even a treatise, which is an in-depth analysis, while mentioning your particular subject area, may give a good discussion of it. It may actually be the topic of a law review article. The advantage, of course, here is giving you your statutes, your important case law, and sometimes what happens is if there's an issue, you know, if there's a split in the court some way or the different ways of analysis, so that you can see the pros and cons of how an argument can be developed.
Right.
So law reviews can be good for that.
And how in-depth you want to go with these secondary sources, you know, whether you want to make the jump from something simple like an encyclopedia to a treatise is going to depend a lot on what type of assignment you have and what type of thing you're going to have to turn in. You know, the encyclopedia, if it covers your state, you know, like New York jurisprudence is an encyclopedia for New York, that is an answer for you. You're just trying to figure out if this guy has any potential claim. That might be enough. But if there's any nuances to the case, or you need to write a memo or create some sort of deliverable, you're going to want to go to a treatise. And then to actually find out how what section of a treatise you're going to be looking at. This is actually is just the index from a 9-volume set. So that's what you're going to want to look at. You might this is a separate volume. The index is at the end of the site. You open it up. Look for the terms that you're looking for. It'll tell you what chapter and section to go to. And then, you know, if you need to get more in depth, or if there's just so many little complications to your client's problem, then you want to go and look at a law review. And like Tricia said, the PLI ones are a really good practical resource, and there might be a law review article on your topic.
Okay, so we're starting off that. So that's if you know absolutely nothing, you're starting with background to move forward. It could be that your partner actually gave you a statute code section, or sort of using those interchangeably, right?
And if you don't know, like, what the difference between a statute and an act is, go to Kevin's workshop, Civics 101. It's going to be repeating it Monday. It'll also be, like, all of these downloadable as a podcast.
So, the advantage of, as I say, why we love annotated codes. Because if your code section has annotations, it's like we were talking about, you were given a code section, but you still need background information, it will tell you the encyclopedia and the encyclopedia topic and section number. It will refer you to the treatises, your Bibles that you need to know. Notes of decisions. Aha, case law. Notice case law comes in. We haven't even discussed case law here. It's not shown on this slide here, but what it will also do is it will cross-reference to related code sections. That it's like, if you are interested in this, you probably are interested in this as well. And it will also give you CFR, that's Code of Federal Regulations, sections that are derived from this code section. And here again, you need to understand how all of this fits together in that Civics 101. If there are forms, we've not talked about forms a great deal, but you are sometimes asked to draft particular documents, and there are standard forms that you can use as a template, and this is why you are paying all of the big bucks to go to law school, so that you can learn how to manipulate the template to get the form you need. And of course, if there's an appropriate form, it will show up in the annotations. And last but hardly least is the historical notes that give you the history of this particular section. That leads us into
it's legislative history. So you might find that you're actually going to have to make an argument regarding statutory intent of a code section. And so you don't need to go through all the steps of looking up one thing leads to another, gives you the numbers for the document that you're finally looking for, because if you just look at the statute, down past the text of the statute is what's called credits, that tells you the different laws that amended the statute. Down below that, it tells you amendments in an annotated statute. And see here, this tells you what these amendments actually did. So in practice, that's very helpful, because most times that you would be looking for legislative intent, it's going to be just actually about one subsection. And the statute could have been amended 100 times, but your subsection might have only been amended 5 times. So those are the amendments that would be important to you. And then down below this in the statute, and obviously if you're looking at it in a book, it'll be on the next page or whatever, that there will be a list of some of the congressional documents that actually talk about the legislative intent of the statute. So you can see from this that if you start out with the statute, it was given to you as part of your assignment, or maybe you're replying to a brief and the opposition mentioned the statute in the brief, like your client violated this statute. You don't need to go around searching other places to start finding things. It's going to be all listed right in the annotations to the statute.
So, instead of giving you a statute, your assigning partner said, the agency regulates this. So, you may want to take a look at the agency's website. This is here. If you don't, you can always Google the agency. It's very good that way. But if not, the USA.gov is the official entry point for our federal bureaucracy. They have a list of agencies. And you can drop down, you can find it here. And on the this side is the homepage for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And if you looked at that, you would see that they actually have a list of laws and regulations. So they will actually pull out the code sections that they use, the regulations they use, the administrative decisions they use. They can give depending on the agency, they may have reports of some kinds that are talking about particular issues, maybe press releases. So an agency website can give you is also a starting point. Now, the issue with the agency website is, I could say it's, in some ways it is annotated because the material is there, but in many cases you really need to know what you're looking for. So what I would do is, if you're not really certain what code section you want to look for, would be go to the agency website, get your code sections, and then go get your annotated code. It depends on what your work style is. There are different ways to do different activities, and what we think some ways are more productive. Here, everybody works differently, so you have to figure out what works for you. So agency websites. After that, we're getting cases. Here there's the workshop location to help you find primary sources. That includes cases. So what we want to do here is, if you have cases, you can start off, like if you were given one, we call it the one good case method, would be to go to the West Digest, get your topic and head number, and then go to a print digest in your jurisdiction to find additional case law. The digest is a subject method of finding case law, as opposed to
searching. Yeah, you don't want to start out by searching.
you know, start out with the digest if one's available to you. But, you know, if you're going to search to round out what you found already, or you haven't found anything, then you want to remember to identify your information needs. You know, what is it that you're looking for? What's your assignment? Think about rephrasing the question in your own words, and then also thinking about what are the terms of art that are going to be used in the cases, because those are going to be your search terms, and they probably come up if you've seen any articles or treatises already. There, you've seen these terms being thrown around, and so once you've thought of, okay, what are probably the terms I'm going to need, it's really important to select the correct database when you're searching for cases, because when you do like an all cases search, that can be a lot more expensive than doing New York State cases. So if that's all you're looking for, then you've saved some money, and you've also gotten rid of all the stuff that's completely irrelevant to your search. And there are a lot of other good ways to be cost effective when you're searching cases. Some of them were gone over in the previous workshop by the law firm librarians about cost efficient research, and that's of course that audio file is downloadable.
Okay, I was just going to very quickly point out with the here, I just grabbed a digest, the West outline of the law, subject method. So you've got your outline, and then your digest topics are really just the various points within the outline in alphabetical order. And, of course, each of those topics, they have their outline for the topic with your key number attached to them. So it really is a very efficient system. It worked for something like 150 years very well before Lexis and Westlaw came along. And it's still very useful. So you have your digest. But here we go then with your cases, is to update your cases. Shepherdizing key citing. You've all heard this. Probably your writing instructors have said this, always say, you always shepherdize. You want to make sure it's still good law. Well, you also want to make sure that your statutes and regulations are also still good law before you submit the document. So updating is very, very important. And just to point up here with Shepherd's and Keysight, if you're using that, here again, this goes with the one good case method, and because you don't have a digest, you've got your case, but you don't have a print digest, you can actually use Shepherd's and Keysight using your case citation to help you find the secondary resources, additional case law. And you can also use them if you have a huge result list. You know, it all depends on your result list. Is the focus and locate functions in
Shepherd's and Keysight.
Yeah, I forget which one is on which one. It's the same function. So that what you're doing is with focus and locate, you are actually searching within your Shepherd's results. So
yeah, that's very helpful. A lot of people don't know that those are, you know, actually very useful for research and not, you know, for more than just updating cases. But if you happen to be in a situation where your firm is very small, you don't have money to use those things, and maybe with the particular matter you're working on, you also don't have time to go to to Hofstra's library or to another library where you can access them within the library. There's some free ways to update those. For cases, there's this one, the New York State Reporter's site. That's very New York specific. It's only going to cover recent New York cases. For regulations, though, The ECFR is, just about as good as anything else that you're going to get, and it's not that complicated. It's put out on the government printing office website for updating federal regulations. And then statutes, the Legal Information Institute at Cornell regularly updates their version of the United States Code. They have a free U.S. code online, and it's not like any other annotated version. It's not official, but it's pretty reliable. So you've looked at secondary sources. Maybe you started with the statute, then that led you to some secondary sources, or maybe the secondary sources led you to the statute, and then cases. Then you might have even had to go into law reviews, and you might have seen within the secondary sources and the cases that there were regulations for your particular problem. And, you know, these things start referring back to each other, and what you might start asking yourself is, well, you know, when do I have enough? When can I stop looking for this stuff? Tricia, when can you stop?
when can you stop? Actually, most of the time you don't really stop. But what we have is legal research is a process. Does anybody in here read science fiction? Has anyone heard of the Worm Ouroboros? No. That's not unusual. But anyhow, the Worm Ouroboros is otherwise known as the snake eating its tail. And I sometimes think of legal research as the snake eating its tail, because sometimes it's hard to tell exactly where you started and exactly where you're going to end. But it goes around and around in this circle. So what you do, you're given your assignment. You have facts, you have issues, and based on this, you start with your initial analysis and select new keywords, key concepts, what you need to do. Remember, always keeping in mind what you're trying to accomplish, the resources that you're going to use. And, you know, you may be keeping track of the additional keywords or acronyms that you find, cases that look like they may be on point, references to regulations. So you look at all of this and you think about it. And looking at this, you may have to refine your research and sort of start all over again. And it depends on where, you know, what you have as a starting point. As I said, this can change. We have starting points as secondary sources, code sections, or case law. They're all correct starting points depending on the information you have and what you're trying to accomplish. But you move from one, you go to another, and you just keep sort of circling around. You should start seeing the same cases coming up over and over, similar analysis coming up over and over, and that's at least a good hint that you're on the correct track. Then you update to see if you can update that information. So if you go on here, you keep on circling until you feel that you've got a pretty good answer, you have brought it up to date, put it in the sort of final format that the assigning partner has requested, and at that point you can stop.
Yeah, and that does sometimes help answer your question, is what is it that you're trying to turn in? Do you have enough to make this document? And are you comfortable making it with the research that you have? And let me just clarify, just so it's absolutely clear about what Tricia said about cases being a starting point. That's when you have a case already. Someone, like, gives you the name or the citation to it. Don't start by searching for cases.
Handing in, going on to Lexis and Westlaw and doing a freestyle and natural language case search, and then handing in your result list, usually does not make the partners very happy.
Your job will get sent to India if you do too much of that.
Yeah, and, you know, I use that example because I have heard from firm librarians of young summer associates and new associates doing exactly that. And then they don't understand what they have done incorrectly. I also want to point out, this is something that comes up, is generally do not start your research with Google. Or if you are going to Google, have a very clear idea of why you are Googling. Now, it could be something here, I will say here, say you are doing background information on a client of something that happened. You may want to Google news to see if there's something in the news for additional background information. Or you're looking for company information. If it's a big company, you go to the website. Many of them, the public companies, actually have the information available through their website. So it's not saying don't ever do it. But if you are going to Google, at least understand why you're Googling and what you're trying to accomplish. This may also come back to what resources you have available. You may not have some of the resources available wherever you are, in which case, you know, if you were looking for scholarly articles, you may want to go to Google Scholar and try that. But here again, it's be clear as to why you are selecting your resource.
Okay, so we know that you guys probably aren't going to be able to remember exactly everything that we've gone over. So what we're going to leave you with is just some questions that you should remember to ask yourself each time that you get a research assignment. And that's just, do you understand the assignment, actually? I mean, more than just parroting back what someone told you it is, do you understand what it is that you're trying to figure out? And do you understand what your goal is? Are you trying to write a contract? Are you trying to write a brief? Or is it just kind of a yes or no question to answer for someone? And so that is, what are your information needs? So that is how in-depth are you going to have to get, and also how what is it that you need? It may not even be legal research. What are the resources that are available to you? You know, that's a big question. That's going to, in some cases, determine a lot of what you're looking at. You may have access to a ton of things. You may have access to very few things. Or you may have access to a ton of things, but you don't actually have the authorization to spend the money on, you know, all but a quarter. And do you know how to use the resources that you have available to you effectively? We're going to trust that, you know, kind of at this point, or at least by the time you graduate, you'll know something about searching on Lexis and Westlaw, because there's a lot of programs about that, and we know that you guys do a fair bit of that. But you should realize that any other resource that you go on is going to have its own nuances, and you might want to try using it a couple times. Help screens are very very effective to, you know, to getting you to learn how to use an online resource quickly. And then once you think you're wrapping up your research, have you actually relied on multiple resources, or did you just kind of look at one thing and basically copy the analysis there? Because, as you know, as you might have seen already, the analysis on the same topic can vary a little bit in some of these resources. They'll still give you the same core, but there's sometimes some variation on someone's opinion about the, you know, some author's opinion about the nuances of a particular issue, and
and what, you know, what these cases said about it. You know, there can be minor disagreements about what the cases actually said.
Well, just part with multiple resources. The other thing is, going back to what I said earlier about people researching differently, is you may find one format particularly useful to you, but if you look at another format in another resource, it's going to bump up something that you hadn't thought about and missed in the original format. Remember when we were looking at the agency website with the laws and regulations on the agency website, I had suggested also, when you had those here, but you look at it in another format in a print code, which is, you know, your law better be the same in both sources. That's the text of the code section. But they're different formats, and so you're going to retrieve different types of materials from both of them. That's why we recommend that. So that was our overview of legal research as a process of putting it all together.
And we encourage you to go to the other workshops if you haven't, or to listen to the files, download them, because those really supplement what we were talking about here.
And thank you for coming.
Thank you. Have a pleasant evening, everyone.
You too. Enjoy. And that's your laptop?
It's the different laptop that I'm taking in my office, yeah.
No. Okay. No.
I do want you to shut it down. Okay. I usually leave it on shut down, and then I do have to reset. Thank you.